The Tom Woods Show, episode 2293.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here, and I'm delighted to have our old friend Sean Rittenour with us. One of the many people I could stand to talk to more often, and for some reason, I do not. But we have the good fortune of talking to him today. We are talking in particular about his brand new book on an extremely important topic, and it's called The Economics of Prosperity, Rethinking Economic Growth and Development. This is really getting to the question of what makes countries wealthy. And in a way, especially when we talk about development policy, we can also implicitly be talking about what does not make them prosperous, what fails, what does not work. So we want to talk about what are the ingredients. And sometimes in this day and age, we have a lot of professional economists who don't quite get this right. They have one or two of the ingredients, but maybe not all of them, or they don't exactly know how they work together. So Sean is going to set them straight by means of this book and this podcast episode today. So welcome back, Sean.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I'm always thrilled to be on your show and particularly excited because, as you may remember, last year at the Austrian Economic Research Conference, I was put into an author's panel.
Oh, well, can I please tell this story instead?
Do you mind if I tell this story?
Okay.
Please do.
First of all, I neglected to mention that you're a professor of economics at Grove City College.
Yes.
Where Hans Senholtz taught. It's a great, great, great place. But yeah, I forgot about this. I was going to tell this and then I forgot it until you mentioned it. So the Mises Institute has a scholarly research conference every year. It's called the Austrian Economics Research Conference. And they have a panel for authors of new books. And I have been on that panel with my books in the past. Well, this particular year, I haven't published a book in a long time, but I was chairing the panel. So I would introduce each person and each person would come up and discuss some new book. But you at that time, you did not have your book published. You didn't have the manuscript finished. You were presenting a chapter of a forthcoming book.
Yes.
So I introduced you by saying, ladies and gentlemen, the book panel at the Austrian Economics Research Conference has reached a new low.
Yes.
Now we're just talking about a chapter in an unpublished book. For some reason, I don't know why I got such mischievous delight out of introducing you that way.
Oh, because that's just the way you are.
Is that how you remember? Is that what you were going to say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. Yes. And so I think it's particularly thrilling that within the first few weeks of its publication, I appear on your show with a bona fide, completed, hard copy book in hand. So, you know, I wasn't just making things up.
No, that's right. That's right. If you're patient enough, Sean's chapter becomes a book. That's what we learned.
That's right today.
All right. So what you're doing in this book really is showing that the Austrian school has particular insights that are helpful in this question of development. So you've got chapters on particular topics. And we will talk about some of these particular topics. But really, it is a question of how do countries go from being poor to being rich? Is that fundamentally what you're looking at?
Yes, that's right. And yeah, I would say you're correct. I remember the germ of the book goes back, well, since I've been at Grove City College, I've been teaching a class on economic expansion development. So I've been thinking about these issues for a long time. And you know, it becomes apparent if you know history at all, you realize that we're living in an age of unprecedented material prosperity that, say, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, people couldn't even, I mean, well, 100 years ago even, they couldn't dream of what we have now. And yet, because of the material prosperity now, people will look around and they will feel and think that prosperity is the normal state of affairs. And if somebody is not prosperous now, something bad must have been done to them. It's like prosperity is a normal thing. Being rich is normal. Why are these countries poor? And in fact, the better question to ask, of course, is given the history of poverty being the norm, how did anybody become rich? how did anybody become more wealthy? And then, of course, after a certain number of countries did experience tremendous economic prosperity and increases in economic prosperity, what did keep certain countries behind? So I think that's the relative question. What is it that can make countries more prosperous? What explains economic progress? And before we look at the lack thereof.
Now, there are maybe politically motivated answers to these kinds of questions. Like a Marxist might think that economic exploitation is keeping a country down and that exploitation takes forms that, let's say, you and I might not recognize as exploitation. Or the way the development literature, maybe in the 1960s and thereafter,
yes,
looked at the question, there needed to be some kind of external help to make countries prosper. So, of course, that led to the question, if external help is necessary for a country to prosper, how did the first countries ever prosper when the first ones couldn't have gotten any external help because they were all poor at the beginning? So how did they become prosperous? You know, so, or, you know what, here's, Dan, this maybe will get right into the heart of your book. Sometimes you see economists these days point to technology, and they say technology is a real path to increased prosperity for obvious reasons, right? We see miracles of technology around us that increase productivity, that make our lives better and more pleasant. And so technology plays a central role, according to them. And it's not to say that technology plays no role, but there is a sense, based on what you're saying in your book, that the technology people are putting the cart before the horse.
Absolutely. Technology is one of the more recent sort of iteration of what I call the monocausal explanation, that you go through these different potential causes, like, say, capital, and then you realize, no, it's not just capital. Does it diminish your returns? So technology explains everything. Well, yeah, technology is fine if you can get it and if you can make it operational. But if you understand technology is just the knowledge of how to do something, knowing how to do something without having means that you can apply to actually do the thing doesn't help you in terms of economic output. In other words, the producer has to have more than just the knowledge of how to do it. You have to have actual capital goods in which the technology is embodied. And so the idea that, well, okay, technology is the thing that explains it. Well, no, if you just only have technology without, say, saving an investment, the technology is going to be unhelpful. As I lay it out, you need a number of what I call sources of prosperities or factors that assist with prosperity. You need these things all working together, not in isolation, but in other words, a true theory of economic prosperity is not merely one of analysis, but it's also one of synthesis.
Well, for example, obviously a major ingredient is indeed capital goods.
Yes.
And that comes about by means of saving, by abstention from consumption, saving and investing in capital goods that can be used for various purposes, but that whose ultimate result is a greater, wider variety of consumer goods. But the thing is, it can't just be we just need capital goods, because maybe there might have been a lot of capital goods in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Maybe there were plenty of capital goods there, but there's a problem when you live under the Soviet Union. You can have all the capital goods in the world, but then what's your problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Soviet Union at one point, after Khrushchev said that they're going to bury us, and I, you know, growing up thought, when he said, we'll bury you, I thought he meant like under the rubble of an armed conflict. But no, he meant economically they're going to bury us, because they were going to devote so much of their productive capacity in producing certain industrial goods. And they did that. And on paper, it looked great. But they produced, I don't know, a certain multiple, like three times as much concrete as they needed. And because of that, because they created so much more concrete, that was not productive activity. That's economic waste. They squandered resources producing way more units of certain goods and not nearly enough of other goods that people wanted. So that's capital investment per se. Even capital investment per se is not going to result in economic prosperity. It has to be allocated to producing the right kind of goods. Similarly, you know, a lot of people, and Adam Smith, if you go clear back to Adam Smith, Smith writes The Wealth of Nations as a book on economic expansion. It's, you know, an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. What causes nations to be wealthy? And he starts out by saying, oh, it's a division of labor, because the division of labor increases the productivity in tasks. Well, okay. And then, of course, later on, he talks about the importance of thrift to keep the wealth of nations ball rolling. But if you start out with a division of labor, that's fine. But how in the world does a division of labor get coordinated? How is it that people are actually specializing and producing goods that are actually going to be helpful? And once you sort of back up, say, well, that's a good question. And then you realize that the division of labor is not possible without a significant capital structure. Well, then how does the capital structure get coordinated? Well, that's a good question. And then how is it that the capital goods that are being used are using or embodying economically viable technology? That's another good question. And you find out that, well, all of these decisions, all of this activity within the market division of labor, within the capital structure, utilizing particular technologies, it all has to be coordinated by the entrepreneur. So the entrepreneur is a person that sees to it that the same and invested capital is allocated towards their most productive uses, of course, because if they're not, then the entrepreneurial world reap losses. And eventually, if they don't get better, they'll cease being an entrepreneur. So that's what I mean when I say, you know, you can't just look to sort of the mono cause and says, well, okay, this is the silver bullet that explains all of economic progress. No, all of these different contributors have to work together. And in order for them to work together, we need an entrepreneur that's able to coordinate all the economic activity within the economic order.
So it's division of labor, that's specialization.
Yeah.
We also need market institutions. So that is to say, we want protection of private property and a robust legal order and whatever. But then also we want, well, I suppose within those market institutions would be a regime you would hope would have enough of a light touch as to allow for saving and investment that gives rise to capital goods. But then you have the entrepreneur overseeing the whole process and allocating resources in such a way that they're led to their most value productive uses and at the lowest opportunity cost, so with fewer opportunities foregone. So the entrepreneur is the central oversight figure of this whole process. And yet what's odd is, if you look at Adam Smith, whom I have great respect for, I don't think Adam Smith was just a waste of everybody's time. I do have a lot of respect for Adam Smith.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's an entrepreneur in Adam Smith. So how is it possible to tell this story without that?
Well, I think that's just a notable weakness in Smith's discussion. I think a lot of it's presumed. I think that, for instance, if you have a relatively free society, entrepreneurs are free to do these things. And so if you look out there and you just sort of see them happening, you can sort of take them for granted. You can take the entrepreneur for granted, which is in some ways, which a reason why I don't think the entrepreneur shows up much in Smith or in a good number of classical economists. I mean, in the French liberal school, they had a better understanding of the entrepreneur. They didn't take him for granted.
Who are examples of people in the French liberal school?
Ah, well, that would be people like Jean-Baptiste Say, the precursor, Richard Cantillon, Frederick Bastiat, and others. But those would be the ones that most come to mind.
I think also, though, Austrians seem more interested in the entrepreneur, at least this definition of the entrepreneur. Do you think it's safe to say than any other school of economics?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look through even sort of modern theories of economic growth, for instance, going back to the Keynesian Harrod-Domar model, you've got Solow's growth model. You even have Paul Romer's endogenous growth model that sort of developed in the 80s. You read through these modern summaries of growth theory published in this century, you don't really find a discussion of entrepreneurship. You find these, I don't know, different individual determinants such as capital investment, technology, human capital investment, things like that. Really, the only one that comes to mind that puts strong emphasis on entrepreneurship as a catalyst for innovation and hence development would be William Baumol. William Baumol had done some good work in this area, but he's like about the only well-known person that I can think of that identifies the entrepreneur with economic prosperity, with the exception, of course, of Joseph Schumpeter. For Joseph Schumpeter, the entrepreneur was very important.
But I wonder if this is because so much of modern economics is preoccupied with an end state, with a long-run equilibrium. In long-run equilibrium, there's nothing for the entrepreneur to do. The idea of the entrepreneur in the Austrian conception is that you have this dynamic, ever-changing economy where resource availability is changing and knowledge is changing and people's tastes are changing. And so the entrepreneur is constantly allocating resources in light of these ongoing changes. But if we're at the end of the changes, and this is it, these are the prices of everything, then I can understand why you'd leave the entrepreneur out, because by skipping over the interesting part, you've left out a role for him.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you put your finger on it right there. When you have your models of analysis that assume perfect information, that assumes perfect information about the future, so every producer knows what its demand actually is, there is no uncertainty. And so there is no need for the entrepreneur. At best, all we need are managers that basically see to it that the goods are produced according to what the mathematic equations tell us. And in some sense, all of the supposed answers are completely baked into the mathematical functional cake. So that's right. There's nothing for the entrepreneur to do because there's no uncertainty. There's no occasion for an entrepreneur to do anything. So that type of analysis can provide some very elegant mathematical results, but because it eliminates uncertainty, it creates in large part results that are pretty irrelevant for the real world in which we all have to live. And so that's why I think the Austrian perspective is able to provide insights and helps us sort of develop a more general theory of economic prosperity than the standard conventional economics, whatever variety we want to talk about.
Hey folks, with my sponsor CrowdHealth, let's commiserate for a minute. Every monthly bill you pay, you know exactly what you're getting. Rent or car payments or groceries or whatever. But with healthcare, it's not quite the same thing. It's confusing. Then when you actually have to use your benefits, there are deductibles, claims processes, other red tape to deal with. Or maybe they're just not going to cover it at all, even though you're spending a fortune every single month. Well, CrowdHealth puts you back in control of your healthcare and helps you pay for health expenses. So we all know the American healthcare system is screwed up. And we all know that third-party payment has made it even more screwed up. Well, CrowdHealth is simple, transparent, and affordable. Here's how it works. As a member, you'll get a personal care advocate to help navigate the complexities of health events. Your personal care advocate will even negotiate bills on your behalf. They'll be with you every step of the way. Could save you thousands in health bills in the process. You'll get access to a crowd of thousands of other members who are ready to help pay for large health expenses. $40 of your $175 monthly payment helps pay for your care advocate, telemedicine services, discounted prescriptions, and other tools to get you the best care at an affordable price. The remainder of the monthly payment goes into a CrowdHealth account that you own, so you can help others in the crowd pay for their medical expenses as well. Experience healthcare freedom with CrowdHealth. Visit joincrowdhealth.com/woods to get your first 3 months for just $99 per month. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. Well, let's take a diversion for a minute into modern growth theory and spend a little time on the wrong way to look at things, or at least a way that needs some modification.
Yeah.
Who are the people, the main figures behind modern growth theory, and what are they saying? And do you think anything is salvageable from it? And where does it need some modification?
I would say that most contemporary growth theory is built upon, or sort of is a reaction to, or built upon Robert Solow's neoclassical growth model, in which the entire economy, I kid you not, the entire economy is modeled as one giant short-run production function. And of course, this is heroically abstract and unrealistic. But this model says that, yes, if we get saving and investment, we will get increased output, but there's diminishing marginal returns to capital. If population is fixed and the land is fixed, there's diminishing returns to capital. And so every time we invest resources and more capital, that's fine. We'll get a boost in economic output, but the additional boost from an additional increment of capital will be lower. And until at some point we reach a maximum, and if we invest in even more capital, we're not going to get actually a positive boost. That we're going to be at the state where we've gotten all of the economic growth we can out of increased saving and investment. And once we get there, of course, then other nations can catch up with us, and then there will be this gigantic convergence. Well, historically, it was not a convergence. Historically, for instance, during the 20th century, economic growth in the Americas and in Western Europe and in places like India and China outstripped other parts of the economic growth in other parts of the world, notably sub-Saharan Africa. So you didn't have this sort of general convergence. But on top of that, if you get to that plateau, then you say, well, what then could cause further economic prosperity? What could cause sustained actual economic growth? Well, that's when you have to turn to technology. Technology has to be the thing that pushes you forward. So that leads to this notion of, well, okay, then the real thing is just a focus on technology, which means instead of generating government spending and subsidies and other types of special privilege to capital investment, we will just transfer subsidies and get special privilege towards technological innovation in general. Well, again, all of those types of policies driven by this sort of this modern theory that emphasizes large aggregate variables miss all of the specific economic decisions that have to take place for all of the investment spending, either in general capital goods or specific technological development and innovation and research and development. All of that has to be spent, all of that investment has to be directed wisely for there to be an economic payoff. And if we just focus on the aggregates, the way modern macroeconomists are wont to do, then we miss a big chunk of the story. Because if they're right, then we can get more economic progress that's sustainable with just more spending on the right variable, be it investment or technology or education or what have you. So this approach misses the big picture. And it misses the big picture because it misses the little picture. In other words, the picture that requires the myriad of individual decentralized entrepreneurs making a host of decisions all along the production process.
How does this bear on the question, even though it's not directly related to development, it's still wrestling with the same kinds of issues? The question of industrial policy, which was kind of fashionable in the 1980s, which was to say that instead of this Austrian vision where the entrepreneur forecasts and tries to determine what people are likely to want in the future and which technologies hold promise for profits, that it's better if we have people, let's say, with a longer time horizon. Like, I mean, I have to admit, I don't even know how to make the argument, but it's better for the state, in effect, to figure out what looks promising and then pour a lot of state resources into developing it, because it can pour way more resources than your dinky entrepreneurs can, and that can accelerate economic progress.
Yeah, well, if the state was God, that would be the way to go, I suppose, right? If the state has absolute and complete foresight, that would be fantastic.
But they say that in Asia, they've done it, you know, that Japanese have done it, the Koreans have done it to some degree. On the other hand, the Japanese seem to have picked the wrong industries, at least in a couple of high profile examples, but they'll say it's been done in the real world, and it just goes to show that there's more than one way of doing this. We don't have to have your market fundamentalism, Sean Rittenour.
Well, they can say it, I suppose. And, you know, I think that claiming one thing and actually having it being true are two different things. I mean, let's suppose that the state say, we're going to pick X, and we're going to pour gobs of money into X, and then sure enough, there's an actual positive benefit. They don't actually destroy everything. There's a positive benefit. Well, the bigger question is not, can anyone benefit from government subsidization? Of course, you can benefit from government subsidization. And if you have a particular part of the productive class that gets certain government subsidies and they put it into particular lines of production that actually do pay off, well, of course, it's going to look like they benefit. Yes, that's great. But the question is, in my mind, is opportunity cost. What about the resources that were lost? What about the production that was lost because the resource directed into the special privileged industries? And we'll have no way of knowing exactly how, what alternatives could have been produced. How do we know that the rate of growth that we got was actually more than what we would have gotten without government directing the whole process? What we do know in a free society is the entrepreneurs have every incentive to direct resources to what's going to earn them profits and essentially earning them the most profits given their value scales, given their preferences. And they have every incentive to avoid losses, right? the big thing about the bureaucrat doesn't really have an incentive to avoid loss. Sure, they'd like to have their projects be successful. It's good. It might make them feel better. It adds to their prestige. It allows them to go in front of the parliaments and congressional committees and talk about how, when you've looked at the data as long as I have, I can tell you what we need to do. And it feeds their hubris. So it could do all of that. And so there's an incentive for them to sort of to get things as right as they can or make it look like they're getting right. But they have no incentive to avoid losses, really, because the losses never fall on them. The losses fall on the citizens or the taxpayers. But the entrepreneur has every incentive not only to seek profit, but to avoid losses. And if they do incur losses, then they have to pay the price and they have to either make a change right quick or they're no longer going to be the entrepreneur and the capital that they have control of is going to be handed over to somebody else. And so even if we can point to particular examples, and I'm not even sure that the examples that are pointed to you actually are good examples, even if we could, to me, it seems that those claims completely discount the opportunity cost of the lost production because of the government subsidies and taxation and inflation. And again, it makes an heroic assumption about the far-sighted nature of the bureaucrat that I just think is untenable.
Give us like the elevator pitch, like a minute of, I mean, I think we've kind of touched on it, but given that where I want to go with this, I want to recap for people. What does your model, I hate to call it a model, I don't want to strip it of its dignity by doing that, but describe for us, what does economic progress in a developing country look like in terms of what ingredients went into it and how do they all work together?
Yes.
Let's just hear that explained.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I much prefer theory to model, but in any event...
Yes, correct. Thank you.
I think Smith was onto something when he said that the division of labor is crucial. And the division of labor, where people are able to specialize according to efficiency, that allows them individually to be more productive. And then as they produce as a society and trade with one another, the entire society is more productive. So the division of labor is a key ingredient for economic prosperity. But an extensive division of labor would be impossible without a well-developed capital structure. Capital goods are necessary for people to specialize in production. So if you don't have capital goods, you're not going to be able to specialize in production. And if you don't specialize in production, you're not going to be able to build and develop a well-developed, extensive structure of capital.
Let's pause for a second there, Sean.
Yes.
Because I don't want to assume everybody knows what capital goods are. Can you just describe what you're talking about?
Yeah. So capital goods are what we could call the produced means of production, right? So if you're going to make a flourless chocolate cake, one of the great desserts of mankind, you have to have land, sure, and you have to have labor, right? You're going to have to do some mixing, baking, that's true. And you also need these other factors that go into the cake that have already been produced, right? You need a semi-sweet chocolate, you need eggs, you need butter, you need a pan, you need an oven. So those things are called capital goods. They are tools that enable you to produce more than you would be able to produce without them. And in some cases, they're tools that will allow you to produce the thing that you couldn't produce at all. I mean, you couldn't bake a flourless chocolate cake without an oven. Right? You could try to set it out on a really hot summer day, but maybe it wouldn't even bake then. You have to have a really high level of heat. So those things, those tools, machines, natural resources that are taken from the seed of nature and are ready to be used in production, those are all capital goods. And so in order for the division of labor to function and extend and help then more and more people become more and more productive, we have to have an extensive structure of capital goods at our disposal that we can use as we specialize. And so the division of labor and capital formation together are very important. But of course, not only do capital goods exist, but capital goods also embody a certain level of technology, right? Technology is just a knowledge of how to do things. And so if I want to, for instance, if I'm in a pastry shop and I need to beat some eggs, I can either do it with my fingers, I can do it with a fork, I can do it with a whisk, I can do it with a handheld mixer, I can do it with a stand mixer, and I could do it with like one of these giant industrial strength mixers like you have in giant big cafeterias, right? Those are all different, those are all capital goods with a slightly different type of technology in them. And so different levels of technology can enable the capital goods to be more productive and also hence the land and labor to be more productive. So technology is also something that's important in this mix. But, and here's the kicker that I try to press home, and what's missing from a lot of growth theory, is that the division of labor has to be coordinated. Capital goods have to be allocated towards certain lines of production and not others for economic progress to obtain. We have to produce what people want and not what they don't want. Technology has to be at the right level. There's a whole host of technologies we could use, but not all of them are economically feasible because some of the technologies that in some sense are very physically productive are just too expensive to make economic sense. So all of the activity, all of the utilization of technology, all of the allocation of capital goods, all of the specialization within the division of labor must be coordinated entrepreneurially. And so those four sort of ingredients, the division of labor, capital accumulation, technology, and entrepreneurship, they're all important. But, and here's another but, for all of these things to successfully work together in a synergistic fashion, for these things all to work together, it requires certain legal institutions, social institutions, such as the right to property. The right to private property is important because we would not be able to engage in specialization in the division of labor if we weren't able to trade our excess supply of whatever we produce. And so voluntary exchange becomes very important. Well, we don't have voluntary exchange without private property. In order for capitalists to have the incentive to save and invest, the capitalist has to be assured and expect that if I reap positive rate of return on my investment, I get to keep the rate of return. It's mine, right? So private property is very important too. To be able to have somebody direct research and development towards the most productive and helpful technologies, the researcher, the developer has to be free to research and develop the technology that's most beneficial to them. And then finally, of course, the entrepreneur must be free to pursue profits. And on top of that, he needs to have a way to even calculate profit and loss, which requires market prices. And for the market prices to be meaningful, that again relies on voluntary exchange, which gets back to private property. And a second important social institution is sound money, a monetary system that is not manipulated by the government. Because to the extent that the government manipulates it, it's going to falsify some price signals. And so the entrepreneur is using market prices of expected prices of the product and the price of the factors of production. When those are manipulated to some extent by the government, entrepreneurs are going to be led astray in their profit and loss calculations and are going to end up producing some things that appear to be profitable, but are not, in fact, what's most desired by people in society. And so the institutions of private property and sound money are crucial institutional requirements to get the most of the process of economic prosperity that's made possible by the division of labor, capital accumulation, technological advancement, and entrepreneurship.
Hey, everybody, personal important message from me to you via Policy Genius. If you have family like I do, you know how much your loved ones depend on you. And in a worst case scenario, you would not want them to be worrying about money. A good life insurance plan can give you peace of mind that if something happens to you, your family will have a safety net. They can keep the house, they can manage their expenses, and get back on their feet. Now, if you already have coverage through work, that's great, but employer-sponsored life insurance may not offer enough protection for your family's needs. And if you leave your job, it won't follow you. And by the way, if you've been hesitating because you think you can't afford life insurance, take my advice. Get it. Because when I bought life insurance, I was shocked at how inexpensive it was. I thought, $1 million in coverage? That's going to cost a ghastly amount. Not so. And Policy Genius is going to give you a smarter way to find and buy it. With Policy Genius, you can easily compare life insurance quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $25 per month for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer coverage in as little as a week and avoid unnecessary medical exams. There are no added fees, your personal details are private, and no wonder they have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. Your loved ones deserve a financial safety net. You deserve a smarter way to find and buy it. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Indexcard.com. Now let's go into the world of experience, because some people might think, okay, you have your approach and other economists have their approach. This is a lot of theoretical wrangling, and maybe one theory sounds more plausible than the other, but I want to see for myself, are there any real-world consequences when theories other than yours are attempted to be implemented in quote-unquote helping countries become prosperous that are currently not? So taking the kinds of growth theories that you've talked about that don't quite hit the mark, have we seen in some of the development proposals and programs over the past half century or more any real negative consequences when they've attempted to implement them?
Well, absolutely. It seems to me that the most obvious sort of extreme example of trying to achieve and maintain some level of prosperity through central planning would be, say, the attempts of the Soviet Union and to a certain extent Cuba. When they've tried socialism good and hard, it has been a disaster, right? I mean, Soviet Union really only had like hardcore socialism right at the beginning for about the first 5 years. And within what, 4 or 5 years of their existence, I think approximately 6 million people died, most of them not through war, but most of them through like starvation and malnutrition. So to me, that's the key obvious example that if we get this wrong, there are real consequences. This is not just academic gameplay. This is the real deal. And so unless we prefer death to life and starvation to prosperity, we don't want to have like full-on socialistic central planning. But even if we want to take, well, you know, we don't want to go that far, of course, we just want the government to help willy-nilly. We provide some foreign aid here, some subsidies there, and maybe that will help if we subsidize the right things. Well, I think one of the great virtues, we talked about different mainstream theories. I'd say one of the better conventional neoclassical economists on this is William Easterly. And he's done some great work. And in a book that now is, I guess, over 20 years old, The Elusive Quest for Growth, he documents attempt after attempt after attempt of trying to identify and then sort of subsidize certain projects in the forms of, say, education, debt relief, foreign aid to certain types of activity. Whenever we've tried these things, the payoff's been very, very small. In fact, it's been negligible. And then in many cases, made things completely obviously worse, where we provide foreign aid to governments of countries that are poor because the governments have stifled entrepreneurship. They've stifled capital accumulation. They've stifled the market division of labor. And we've essentially enabled their regime to continue to survive because of the negative consequences of their policy.
They don't have to feel the full negative consequence because they're going to keep getting the stupid money from the U.S. or whoever.
That's right. And it's tough. I mean, it does put, if you have any feeling and soul at all, it does put some of us in Board of Alpefis in a tough spot because, as I said, nobody wants to see 6 million people die because of a horrid policy by a government. And so what can you do? Well, you provide emergency aid, but if the government takes that emergency aid and lines their own pockets with it, the people still die. The track history on foreign aid, even the history of trying to direct foreign aid to those societies which have quote unquote better institutions, have been not successful. Foreign direct investment by private capitalists into countries that do have these better institutions, the rule of law, private property, relatively sound money. And of course, all these things are relative because nobody has a, you know, complete private property or completely sound money. But in those foreign direct investment, allowing people who actually have their own financial skin in the game, when they are able to save and invest, the track record is much better.
So this might be a bit of an inside baseball question, but how does a guy like Peter Bauer, who was kind of a whistleblower on the whole, I don't know if that's really the right word, but he was warning, I think as early as the late 1950s, but certainly by the 60s, warning about misplaced development aid programs and saying that they were bound to have a lot of negative consequences. I don't think he was expressly an Austrian, but he was warning about exactly what wound up happening, exactly what he warned would happen. And nobody listened to him until then later on, Margaret Thatcher, I think, made him Lord Peter Bauer. So he was vindicated later on. but he didn't really want to be vindicated. You know, I'm not saying this because I, 30 years later, I want everybody who got this aid to have been further impoverished so I can get a medal. So how does he fit into this story?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know of any place where he was not a self-professed Austrian or Misesian or anything like that. His work is amenable to Austrians because he writes in English and not in mathematics.
Yeah.
So he is one who does write a little more holistically and from a more humane perspective than assuming an agent with a production possibility set of real numbers, X to who knows where. I mean, he was definitely trying to write an economics that's realistic. And in that sense, there's an affinity between us to he and the Austrians. And he, I think, takes human action seriously. And so he would be a fascinating case if you could sort of get down to brass tacks and sort of ask about more methodological questions. But his output as it relates to economic progress, yeah, he was clearly one who saw the futility of foreign aid and also was an early critic identifying the political nature of foreign aid that, as he put it, what in his mind defined the third world was whether or not you got foreign aid. Had less to do with your actual level of development and more to do with were you getting foreign aid for political reasons. And he has a lot of good stuff to say. You can hardly read P.T. Bauer without learning something.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, you can also hardly read, here's a smooth transition, Sean Ridenour without being filled with insights. So I therefore urge people to check out The Economics of Prosperity, your brand new book, Rethinking Economic Growth and Development. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2293. I'm so glad that the book is no longer a mere orphan chapter, but is a full-blown work. So congratulations there, Sean.
Well, thank you. You know, it was the embarrassment and the scorn I received at your hands which motivated me to finally get it done.
Do you see that what appears to be nastiness is actually just love expressed in an abrasive way?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, again, it's great. It's important. It fills a gap. We don't have anything like this. And you did it. So congratulations. And I hope people will check it out. Again, tomwoods.com/2293 is the show notes page. We'll have it linked there. Thanks so much again, Sean.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.